This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Out to Beverly Hills we go now. Something called the Milken Institute Global Conference. 4 days of mostly business and finance panels and conversations, one of which was me with Ambassador Catherine Tai, the U.S. Trade Representative. We went half an hour, the ambassador and I did. We'll play a couple of parts of that talk today. The global part of global trade comes first.
A couple of months ago, you said to the Senate, the version of globalization that we have right now is fragile, right? And it feeds on our insecurities. Mm. What does that mean, and why do you think that?
All right. Let's talk about globalization, and lots of people talk about it, but it is important to try to define it. So the version of globalization that we have right now, let's just call it globalization 1.0. Yep. It is one through the trade lens that I see that is built on a set of assumptions. And there were very reasonable assumptions, I think, that we had, say, coming out of World War II, which is the more that we trade with each other, the more trade that you can facilitate and liberalize, the better off we all will be. You may have heard people say, countries that trade with each other don't go to war with each other.
I have heard that.
Okay. Now, I think that in the last 2 months, we've seen that that's not necessarily true. So, you know, I think that that's one data point I would highlight. Another one is around the pandemic and the supply chain struggles that we have had, starting with the scramble for PPE to today with a global economic trading system that just remains discombobulated. Shanghai and certain parts of China under lockdown again. We know that these are going to ripple out across the global economy. So this is globalization 1.0, built on the notion that trade liberalization leads to the promised land. And where we find ourselves is not the promised land today in 2022, but in a state of feeling a global fragility and heightened sense of insecurity.
So look, you mentioned Russia, and that's the obvious one, right? The hot war. But let's get to a trade war, which has to take us to China and the efforts we've had for two generations in this country to get them into the global trading system and by doing that, get them to change their behavior. And certainly we have the Trump tariffs, which we'll get to in a minute. I wonder what your sense is of how we're doing with the Chinese. You've said it's dysfunctional. It doesn't work. Our relationship with the Chinese doesn't work.
I don't know that that's the word that, I mean, dysfunctional I will reserve for my description of the World Trade Organization.
That's a whole different thing, but okay.
I choose my words very carefully when I talk about China and the U.S.-China relationship.
Sorry, let me get the quote right.
Yes,
right?
Okay.
Thank you. Unduly difficult.
Yes,
is
difficult.
How you described our relationship with the Chinese.
It is very difficult, especially
unduly
right now.
Unduly difficult.
Sure.
Explain
okay.
that.
I think that our relationship on a bilateral basis has become more complicated over time. As I experience it through the trade lens, I'll take as an example, because I think that you're going to take me here anyway, so let me just preemptively
get there. That's like cheating. I don't know if you're allowed to do that.
It's called taking control of the conversation. So back in October, I announced the administration's approach to the U.S.-China bilateral trade relationship and that we would be beginning our direct engagement with a focus on China's performance under the set of commitments it had made to the U.S. government in what we call by shorthand the Phase One Agreement,
right.
But it's the U.S.-China Trade and Economic Agreement that was signed back in February of early in 2020.
Of which they have completed how much?
Well, I mean, so, you know, the picture is also varied and complicated. There are a number of different types of commitments that China took on, many of them related to their intellectual property protections and their forced tech transfer. So that is a set of commitments that we've been tracking, and you look at whether or not they have passed the laws and regulations that they promised to. In large part, they have. But then you also have to assess for all the companies that are on the ground in China, are they seeing an improved environment in China? And, well, you know, that's going to be up to the experiences of our companies and what they share with us. It's going to be a little harder to measure than, for example, the purchase commitments that the Chinese made. And those everybody is following. We get lots of questions about it because the trade data are public. You can look at the numbers in terms of their commitments on paper, and you can see where there are gaps.
Do you think that the Trump-era tariffs have changed China's behavior?
In certain ways, yes. I think that another question would be whether or not those tariffs have changed firm behavior. And again, I think that in a way, you also see changed behavior.
Explain that a little bit. Firm behavior, American firms?
Sure, American firms, yes. Anybody who is trying to source from China and bring that product into the U.S. has got to contend with this set of tariffs that was built up starting in 2018.
Yep.
What stakeholders have told me is that increasingly firms are engaging in what in the industry is called a China plus one strategy,
yeah.
Where, you know, if you're going to be making things in China and you're going to be selling to the Chinese market, you continue to do that in China. But if you are making things in China and you are going to try to sell that either back to the U.S. or in two other places, firms have seen this situation and have been incentivized to find other bases of operation and manufacturing where they feel that there might be more confidence in terms of the trading relationship to getting that product out of China and into the U.S.
Firms tell you that. Business people that I speak with express incredible frustration with having to actually go through that after having built up their supply chains over decades now. Mm-hmm. And they also wonder why it is that the Biden administration has not decided to get rid of the Trump-era tariffs and save that those import taxes on $300 billion worth of Chinese goods. What's your answer?
So I think that frustration comes from a couple different places. One is a sense of inconvenience. One may be a sense that, in a way, maybe we all wish that we could go back to the way the world was in 2015. That was a version of globalization 1.0 where we were not worried about putting in an order for, I don't know, a piece of furniture or a pair of pants and having to wait 6 months for it to arrive, right? And I think that, you know, what I would say to all of our firms who understandably, and all of our people too, who understandably are sentimental, is that the reason why we are where we are today is that this world was not built for resilience. And so, you know, I think that the issue that we're dealing with right now is we want to transition from globalization 1.0 to globalization 2.0. And I think that, you know, the really interesting conversation is around what does globalization 2.0 look like?
Well, so that's the question, right? Let me stop you there and say you've described 1.0 and what it looks like and the fragilities. What is 2.0? And more importantly, does it spare us the fragilities?
That would be the idea. In the new version of globalization, our firms, our governments need to be focused on decision-making and behaviors that are not just focused on efficiency, chasing the lowest cost, right?
Right.
But where we're all incentivized to reward and build towards resilience. And what does resilience mean? Resilience means more choices, more options, less vulnerability, and ultimately being better prepared because you don't know where that next crisis is going to come. You don't know its nature, so you just need to be prepared.
Back we go to the Milken Institute Global Conference, where yesterday, in between the hobnobbing and the schmoozing, that was other people, not me, I spent a half an hour on stage with Ambassador Catherine Tai, the U.S. Trade Representative, talking in this section about the domestic side of global trade.
I can't see the screens, but when we were walking in, I noticed your Twitter handle was up there and mine was up there as well. And you or I'm going to assume your staff tweeted at me this morning and said, can't wait to join Kai Rizdal at Milken to talk about the Biden-Harris administration's worker-focused trade policies. Mm. You have to convince the American public that trade is a good thing. Mm. Go.
Okay. Well,
you've got 90 seconds.
All right. Let's start with this. I think that a lot of the American public either isn't thinking about trade, or if they think about it, have a sense that people in this job are not thinking about them, and frankly, haven't thought about them in decades, and haven't designed globalization 1.0 for them.
You want to know why? And we talked about this again last time you were on Marketplace,
I know,
right? Because we could go out on Wilshire Boulevard and stop 10 people,
yeah.
And if we said global trade, they would say, "Oh God, tariffs! I hate trade."
Kai, I think that we really need to go out and test
that out. We should just do it, actually.
We really need to test
that's
it because
should,
I,
yeah.
I take your point.
We should have done like a Jimmy Kimmel thing and gone out there. Anyway.
I take your point that I question your numbers.
It would be 9.5 out of 10.
Well, you
I
see, I don't know how to define half a person, but let's take your point that people are associating trade with tariffs right now. Well, there are a ton of people out there who associate trade with offshoring and outsourcing and the loss of jobs and the loss of a significant amount of America's manufacturing industrial base. We have globalization 1.0 is built on catering to a human element that we have only conceptualized as the consumer. Right? So a lot of the arguments around the benefits of trade are you're going to have low prices and lots of variety at the marketplace.
Right.
All right. And yeah, no, I mean, there's a luxury to that and something that we've enjoyed for a long time.
But people
are not just consumers. They are also workers. They're also earning money, and they are also having to compete in a global marketplace for talent where globalization 1.0 has really eroded opportunities and wages for your average American. So the point that I have to make is, I get this. From now going forward, as we devise our trade policies, we are going to be thinking about the human component of our economy centrally, and we are going to be thinking about how we justify our policies to benefit our people. And if the policies we're thinking about don't benefit our people, then those cannot be the policies that we pursue.
So let me back you up for a second. Mm-hmm. The idea that we've come to think of, or that low prices are a luxury, right? I would submit that the American consumer certainly thinks it's their right. I've always had low prices. Mm. And now you're going to change that?
Yeah.
What are you going to give me in return?
I'm going to give you a sense of security and confidence that clearly have been broken in this moment, which is, and I wish I'd looked this up because I've been thinking about this part of The Great Gatsby. Near the very, very, very end.
Cecil Slee into the past or whatever it is?
Not that part. Not that where Nick Carraway says something like, you know, the revelation that the rock of the world is founded on a fairy's wing.
Huh.
It was much more beautiful because F. Scott Fitzgerald. But I'm close. I've got most of the words in there, right? So there is a sense of confidence and strength that we had and, you know, this right to low prices that was built on something that was very fragile. I think going forward in terms of globalization 2.0, we need to have those hard conversations. A more resilient, a stronger, more sustainable future is one that is going to look different and feel different. But the focus that we have is on ensuring that the rock of the world is actually founded on a rock. One that is better prepared for the next challenge, and one that has a kind of an insurance that is built into it to make sure that the next time there's a crisis, we don't have that panic and sense of desperation that we have been experiencing for the last couple years.
Do you think we can do it?
I think that, I absolutely think that we can do it.
The U.S. Trade Representative Ambassador Catherine Tai with me out at Milken yesterday. A very quick part 3 coming up on this program tomorrow.